Right now, there's $161 billion of private equity just sitting in Australia.
Yeah, literally just waiting to be deployed.
Right, waiting to be spent. But despite all that cash, investors are terrified to actually write a check.
Absolutely terrified.
So why is that? Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking you through a landscape where that old financial formula of, buy, cut costs, and flip is just completely
It's
dead.
gone. The whole playbook has changed.
Exactly. We're using a really fascinating May 2026 report by Byron Thomas Recruitment for this. It's titled Australia's PE and VC Landscape in 2026-27, Capital Control AI and the C-Suite Hiring Test.
It's a heavy title, but the insights inside are
They
incredible.
really are. And our mission today is to give you, the listener, a shortcut to understanding this massive dramatic shift. Because for a long time, private equity felt a bit like, flipping a house in a booming real estate market.
Yeah, where everyone looks like a genius.
Right. You buy a property, you slap on a fresh coat of cheap paint, fix the obvious cosmetic issues.
Maybe add a bit of leverage.
Exactly. Load it with debt and turn around and sell it for a profit a year later. As long as the broader market was going up, you couldn't really lose.
But the momentum of that market used to, it hit a lot of operational sins. Now we are looking at a total shift from purely financial engineering to genuine high-pressure operational execution.
Which means they don't just want the cosmetic fixes anymore. They want to see the architectural blueprints.
Right. And they want to conduct a rigorous interview with the general contractor before they hand over a single dime. The ultimate test of a company's survival now rests squarely on the C-suite.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the first thing you might assume when you hear investors are terrified to write a check is that the money is simply dried up.
That there's a drought.
Yeah, a capital drought.
Right.
But the hard numbers in this report tell a completely different story, don't they?
What's fascinating here is that it is not a drought at all. It's an elevation of standards.
Yeah, the data is staggering. The Australian Investment Council's 2026 yearbook shows a massive $161 billion in private capital assets under management.
That's a lot of dry powder.
It's insane. Within that, you've got $51 billion in private equity and $21 billion in venture capital, boasting 12.7% returns.
And that's not even all of it. The PwC 2026 M&A Outlook adds even more weight to this. They report total Australian deal value at $79.5 billion.
With private equity buyouts actually jumping up by 32% to $30.5 billion. So the money is moving.
It is moving, yes. But we are also seeing a normalization in the broader market. KPMG's data shows that deal value is sort of settling down after that massive AirTrunk deal.
Oh, right, the data center buyout.
Yeah, that $24 billion buyout that completely skewed all the statistics last year. Now, the activity is shifting heavily toward mid-market healthcare, industrials, and financial services.
So, if there is so much dry powder, like literally billions of dollars sitting in funds waiting to be deployed, why are investors acting so skittish? Are they just waiting for a level of perfection that doesn't actually exist in the real world?
Well, it's about a very real liquidity squeeze happening behind the scenes.
What do you mean?
While there's a lot of capital available on paper, the private equity sponsors themselves are facing intense liquidity pressures on their long-held assets. PwC highlighted this mechanism specifically.
So they're stuck with companies they bought years ago.
Exactly. Over the last few years, exits actually selling the companies they bought to realize a profit have been incredibly hard to achieve. Because of that, private equity firms are trapped holding on to companies much longer than their standard 3 to 5 year timeline.
Oh, wow. And their own investors, the limited partners who gave them the money in the first place, are tapping their watches. They want their returns.
Right, they want cash back. So when you are under that kind of pressure from your own investors, your tolerance for risk on the very next deal you make plummets to near zero.
You just can't afford a mistake.
You can no longer accept a vague strategy or an inflated optimistic narrative from a management team. You need concrete, irrefutable evidence that the operating plan can be delivered.
So the market isn't closed, but the bouncer at the door has become incredibly strict.
That's a great way to put it. Sponsors simply will not tolerate weak reporting or a C-suite that doesn't know its own numbers inside out.
And that stringent environment fundamentally changes the pressure cooker the business is sitting in, right?
Yeah.
Especially when we look at where this money is actually coming from today.
Yeah, the rise of private credit is huge here.
The report highlights this massive shift. Now, private credit sounds great on paper because it's, highly flexible, but I have to imagine that flexibility isn't free.
Oh, it is definitely not free.
If I'm borrowing from a private credit lender instead of a traditional bank, they're going to want a level of visibility into my daily operations that most CFOs simply aren't prepared to give.
That's exactly the issue. A traditional bank wants to know your financial weight once a year, maybe once a quarter. A private credit lender straps a heart rate monitor to your chest and sets off a deafening alarm if your pulse dips for 5 minutes.
That sounds exhausting for a management team.
It is. They might not demand the same rigid asset backing that a traditional bank does, but they demand tighter information, incredibly strong covenant discipline, and a razor-sharp focus on cash conversion.
Okay, let's break down cash conversion for a second, because that is the brutal reality of turning a sent invoice into actual money in the bank.
It's the only thing that matters when you have heavy debt.
Right. You can show a massive accounting profit on a polished spreadsheet. But if your clients take 90 days to pay you and your private credit covenants require a massive cash interest payment in 30 days, your profitable company is functionally insolvent.
Which means the days of the reporting-only CFO are entirely dead. In a sponsor-backed or debt-funded business today, if the CFO only knows how to look backward and report what happened last month, the company will hit a wall.
They need to be forward-looking.
Deeply forward-looking. They need to understand lender communication, forecast integrity, working capital, and crucially, they have to manage that tangible liquidity on a daily basis.
This perfectly tees up a concept in the report that I found fascinating, this idea of the diligence illusion.
Ah, yes, the diligence illusion.
Private equity firms spend millions hiring the Big Four accounting firms and massive strategy houses to produce these incredibly polished, beautiful due diligence packs.
We're talking hundreds of pages of charts.
Yeah, charts and models proving why a specific deal is brilliant. But a credible spreadsheet model means absolutely nothing if the internal C-suite team is underpowered.
The diligence pack outlines what should happen in a perfect world. The C-suite determines what actually can happen on a rainy Tuesday when supply chains break down.
Or when a major client defaults. It reminds me of the role investment bankers play here.
Yeah.
The report points out that investment bankers are still crucial. They shape the auctions, they prepare the information memos. But they are essentially the real estate agents who sell you that beautiful house.
Okay, I like this analogy.
They stage the furniture, they bake cookies in the oven so it smells great, and they hand you the keys. But they aren't the ones who have to live in the house when the roof starts leaking 6 months later.
Exactly. And when that roof actually starts leaking, you often realize your executive team inside the house doesn't own a wrench.
They're just sitting there getting wet.
A consultant's report validates the market opportunity, sure, but it does not test whether the management team can actually deliver under the relentless daily reporting cadence of a private equity sponsor.
Since execution is the only reality that matters when the roof leaks, let's look at the people doing the executing. The report argues that C-level hiring has to perfectly match the size, stage, and specific pressure of the company.
It's definitely not a one-size-fits-all corporate ladder. The required psychological and operational profiles are highly distinct.
Let's take a founder-led or early growth company, for example.
In that scenario, you don't need a classic, highly polished, public company-style CFO who expects a team of 50 accountants beneath them.
Right. They'd be totally out of place.
What you need is a hands-on commercial finance leader. You need someone willing to physically roll up their sleeves, clean up the messy historical reporting the founder probably kept in a loose Excel file.
Or on the back of a napkin.
Seriously, sometimes it feels like that. They have to build a reliable forecast and have the friction-filled conversations to challenge the founder on pricing.
But as that company grows into a scale-up or a VC-backed business, that requirement completely shifts.
Yeah.
The report says you have to move from founder instinct to a repeatable operating rhythm.
Because founder instinct doesn't scale infinitely, you eventually hit a ceiling.
Yeah.
In a scale-up, you need a chief operating officer who can translate a high-level vision into rigorous weekly execution.
And what about the revenue side?
You need a revenue leader who understands disciplined, profitable growth rather than just throwing money at marketing to chase revenue at any cost.
And what if you were stepping into a turnaround situation, like a company operating under high leverage that is actively struggling to make payroll?
Turnarounds require a completely different temperament. Cash and stakeholder management are the only things that matter in the short term.
So no big visionary speeches.
The report explicitly warns against that. In these scenarios, hiring a highly charismatic, visionary leader who can't run the numbers is a fatal mistake. You do not need vision. You need a mechanic.
Someone who just gets under the hood and stops the bleeding.
Exactly. You need someone whose raw credibility and grasp of the math buys you time with the private credit lenders.
The McKinsey Portfolio CEO playbook is heavily referenced in this section too, noting that mid-market PE-backed CEOs need strong horizontal management teams around them.
The strongest CFOs act as a critical bridge. They connect the CEO, the daily operations, and the private equity sponsor.
Here's where it gets really interesting. This dynamic naturally brings up the issue of control. The report outlines an autonomy dial.
Yes, the dial.
For a strong founder-led business with great unit economics, the PE firm might have a very light touch. But for a fragmented buy-and-build platform, where you are snapping up multiple small companies and trying to glue them together, the sponsor is heavily involved.
Very involved.
Imagine you've just been hired as the CEO of one of these fragmented platforms. You might expect autonomy, but under this new framework, the PE sponsor is pulling up a chair to your dinner table every single night.
And looking at your plate.
Yeah. So my question for you is the goal for the C-suite to eventually earn their independence back from the PE firm, or is this a permanent marriage where the sponsor is always dictating the menu?
The test isn't whether the private equity firm is involved or not. The test is whether their involvement is actively improving execution.
Oh, interesting.
The sponsor should be sitting at the dinner table if the reporting is unreliable, if the leadership capability is thin, or if the debt pressure is rising.
So they turn the dial up when things are shaky.
Yes, and they should only step back and turn that autonomy dial down when the management team proves they have the capability and the rigorous information systems to run the company flawlessly on their own.
So it's earned.
It's not about the CEO earning independence for the sake of their ego. It's about demonstrating undeniable competence.
If sustainable construction and demonstrating competence is the only way to survive, we have to address the public perception of what these C-suites are actually doing.
The elephant in the room.
Right. When people hear private equity execution, they often assume the management team is just gutting the company. The report acknowledges this debate around financial engineering and short holding periods.
It's a very common narrative.
It points out that when you combine heavy leverage, exposure to essential services, heavy fixed costs, and weak cash conversion, you get the classic buy, gear, extract, sell, or walking away scenario.
Just to clarify the jargon for a second, gearing is loading the balance sheet up with massive amounts of debt.
Thanks for that. So if an investor is looking at a business with those exact characteristics, essential services, and heavy fixed costs, is the risk of it becoming a transactional strip and flip just a natural side effect of the math?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the math certainly leans that way in high leverage scenarios. But the 2026 reality is that the transactional asset stripping model is becoming much harder to pull off.
Really? Why is that?
It is, frankly, less lucrative in a mature market. The next buyer isn't naive. They aren't going to buy a hollowed-out shell for a premium anymore.
They're doing their own due diligence.
Exactly. McKinsey's 2026 Private Markets Report makes a definitive point here. Alpha, which is the excess return on an investment, now comes from genuine operational value creation and leadership development. You cannot just rely on market timing or financial engineering.
You actually have to build the house up rather than just selling off the copper wire inside the walls.
To achieve a successful exit in 2026 or 2027, you have to build sustainable value. The Byron Thomas report highlights constructive case studies that prove this.
Like what?
Look at Bain Capital's rescue of Virgin Australia from administration. That was not an asset strip. That was a highly complex restructuring built around balance sheet repair, rigorous cost control, and restoring actual operational viability.
The report also brings up Pema Capital Partners and their work with Standards, right?
Yes. They were building a mid-market platform by investing in talent, funding mergers and acquisitions, integrating new technology, and expanding the actual service lines.
So the C-suite in those successful scenarios isn't tasked with destruction.
No, they are tasked with rigorous, sustainable construction. You have to leave the company in a fundamentally stronger position than when you found it. Otherwise, the sophisticated buyers waiting at the exit will just walk away.
So if sustainable construction is the mandate, what tools does the C-suite have left? They can't just slash overhead anymore?
They need new levers.
Which explains why every investment committee in the country is suddenly obsessed with AI.
Oh, absolutely. It's everywhere.
The 2026-27 federal budget even highlights it, pushing massive incentives for productivity and AI commercialization. But I hear AI commercialization, and I immediately roll my eyes because literally every single company claims they are implementing it.
And most of them are faking it. The report makes a vital distinction between useful automation and AI theater.
AI theater, I love that term.
Slapping an AI chatbot on your customer service page so you can put it in a pitch deck, that is theater.
Right. It doesn't actually change the business.
Exactly. Redesigning your core data workflows, automating your supply chain forecasting, and fundamentally changing your cost structure, that is useful automation.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? If you are a C-level executive prepping for an interview with a private equity firm, or if you are already sitting in the seat feeling the heat from the sponsor, how do you prove you are capable of executing real automation and not just selling this AI theater?
You prove it by showing AI fluency at a strategic level, not a technical one. Leaders do not need to be coders.
That's a relief for a lot of people, I'm sure.
Definitely. But if you are in the C-suite, you must be able to answer four very specific questions defensively and clearly. First, where exactly does AI reduce cost in your specific business model?
Okay, cost reduction.
Second, where does it improve speed or output? Third, where does it increase risk, particularly regarding data security, privacy, and governance?
That risk piece is huge right now.
Massive. And fourth, who ultimately owns the result when the AI makes an automated decision? If you stumble on those questions, a PE sponsor will look right past you.
And finding the executives who can answer those questions is forcing the recruitment industry itself to evolve. The report draws a sharp contrast between massive global search firms and boutique networks.
It's a completely different approach to hiring.
Right. If a board needs a massive global mandate, they will use the massive firms. But for Australian mid-market VC-backed growth companies or complex founder successions, local boutique search partners are actively winning the mandates. Why is that?
Because they move faster, their local networks are deeper, and they have the commercial grounding to find candidates who have actually survived the specific traumas of this ecosystem.
The specific traumas. Wow.
A global database will easily find someone with a pristine, perfect resume from a Fortune 500 company. But drop that Fortune 500 executive into a mid-market private equity company where the enterprise software is broken, the founder is resistant to change, and the private credit lender is demanding daily cash flow updates.
That executive will completely freeze.
They will. They are used to massive support structures. Boutique firms specialize in finding the battle-tested talent who thrive when the support structures are removed.
Let's bring all of this together for you. We've covered the core mechanics of this Byron Thomas report, and the landscape has just fundamentally shifted.
It's a new era.
The capital hasn't disappeared. There's $161 billion sitting right there in Australia. But that capital has become ruthlessly disciplined due to massive liquidity pressures on the sponsors themselves.
And remember, the polished due diligence produced by massive consulting firms means nothing if you do not have an operational C-suite that can survive a rainy Tuesday and actually execute the plan.
Yes. And finally, true value creation in 2026 and 2027 requires leaders who can navigate strict private credit covenants, bridge the intense gap between founders and sponsors, and implement real workflow-altering AI rather than just throwing around buzzwords in a board meeting.
This raises an important question, though, and it is something I want you to really mull over after we wrap up today.
What's that?
The report clearly states that the best executive hires right now are those who have survived imperfect systems, debt pressure, and integration risk.
Okay.
If the ultimate C-suite test in this new landscape is resilience under immense pressure, does that mean having a slightly messy resume is actually an advantage?
Wait, really? A messy resume.
Think about the implications. If your resume shows you had to navigate a chaotic turnaround, survive heavy debt covenants, or endure a brutal, messy sponsor transition, that means you've been in the trenches when the numbers didn't add up.
You didn't just ride the wave.
Right. Is that battle-tested history actually more valuable to an investor today than a perfectly smooth, unblemished corporate track record where everything always went right?
That is fascinating.
Should ambitious leaders actively seek out imperfect, high-pressure companies just to earn their private equity battle scars?
Seeking out the chaos to prove you can build the architectural blueprints while the house is actively on fire. That is an incredible perspective to leave on.
It's the new reality.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Take these insights, look at your own track record, and carry this operational mindset into your next boardroom meeting or investor interview. We'll see you next time.